In July 1948, Arthur Ransome went to Durham University to receive an honorary degree. He was in good company. Barnes Wallace was honored in the same ceremony for inventing navigational aids, the dam buster bomb still being a secret. The composer Edmund Rubra was also on the list, along with the poet Edith Sitwell. The day did not end well. Once the ceremony was over, Ransome stormed out, refusing to attend the official dinner for the honorary graduates. Thereafter, he systematically removed all biographical references to what I've called the debacle at Durham. You will be hard-pressed now to believe the event took place at all. Ransome's entry in the Dictionary of National Biography doesn't mention it, and there is nothing in either Who's Who or Who Was Who. The search becomes a little like finding one of those photographs that Stalin edited. It's almost as if the event never happened. But it did happen. So my question is, what on earth went wrong? And more to the point, why? The story begins in April 1917 aboard the famous Seal train that the German authorities allowed to carry the architects of the Russian Revolution from Zurich to Petrograd. Among the crowd awaiting its arrival at Finland station was the 33-year-old Arthur Ransome. We shall come back to his reasons for being there. First, I want to consider who was on the train and who wasn't. The passing years have considerably mythologized this journey. The very name itself, Sealed Train, conjures up images of espionage and derring do. Perhaps we're reminded of Graham Greene's Stamboul Train. The truth of the matter is far less romantic. The revolutionaries making their way to Zurich station looked like a bunch of businessmen, sober citizens, one and all, not a banner among them. Very few realised these were, in a sense, emissaries of the German High Command. In 1917, Germany was fighting the Great War on two fronts. For the Chief of General Staff, Max Hoffmann, the Russian revolutionaries, exiled in Switzerland, were a godsend. He deployed them, and I quote, to hasten the undermining and poisoning of the morale of the Russian army. Lenin is to be conveyed through Germany to Petrograd the same way as I send shells into enemy trenches, as I discharge poison gas. I have the right to employ the expedient of propaganda against his garrisons. So Lenin's popular uprising was in fact financed by the German High Command with the aim of extracting Russia from World War I, orchestrated as part of a propaganda campaign of unparalleled sophistication. I want briefly to consider two men at the heart of this affair because both have links with Arthur Ransome, although neither was on the train when he saw it arrive at Petrograd. The first because the Germans refused him permission to travel, the second because he was refused entry to Russia and had to go on to Stockholm. First, the man who never made the journey, Willy Münzenberg, the Red Millionaire. In 1917, Münzenberg's career was only beginning, but without this high priest of propaganda, the revolution may well have foundered. Münzenberg was liberally financed by Lenin with German funds to establish front organizations in support of the Bolshevik Revolution. Over the next few years, he recruited artists, authors, journalists, actors, musicians, and even dancers to the Bolshevik cause. He termed them members of his Club of Innocents. The complete list of individuals who fell under his spell is staggering. Heinrich Mann, Aldous Huxley, François Mauriac, John Reed, H.G. Wells, even Clement Attlee. The contemporary world of conflicting realities in Twitter and Facebook owes much to techniques perfected by Munzenberg. Above all else, he needed journalists, and he assiduously sought them out. In 1917, Arthur Ransome of the London Daily News had in effect defined himself as a prime target. An apparently ingenuous author, a member of Petrograd's elite, someone on first name terms with the great and the good of British political life, someone with an extraordinary web of connections to the British and Russian press and the literary establishment of Paris and London. I will turn now to the second man, Lenin's travelling companion, a Ukrainian political agitator who had adopted Polish nationality, renamed himself Karl Radek. Radek shared a compartment with Lenin on the Seal train, a compartment piled high with newspapers in dozens of languages. Arthur Ransome's work for the Daily News was prominent. Radek was highly intelligent, spoke half a dozen languages, all of them very badly, according to Ransome. He became Bolshevism's minister of propaganda, editor of its periodical, The Torch. Described by one historian as the jeering cynic of the revolution's rationale, Radek had a pathological interest in lying. Everything really important, Radek claimed, was based on falsehood. As a result, falsehood became a kind of truth. We shall come back to this paradox. This was the man charged with implementing the political seduction of Arthur Ransome. Radek was not allowed to leave the train in Petrograd. He returned after the October Revolution and became Vice Commissar for Foreign Affairs. He was among those who negotiated Russia's removal as a combatant in the Great War, realizing Germany's principal strategic ambition, albeit at horrendous cost to the Russian population. If we're to believe Ransome's autobiography, Karl Radek became a close friend, a confidant, someone he appeared to admire. Indeed, the versions we meet of him through biographies generally present him as an almost comic character, scurrying between Europe's capitals, waving his outsized revolver, orchestrating revolution with an impish grin. I confess I find all this difficult to swallow. It's a little like reading that Adolf Hitler was really a good-natured chap when you got to know him. The ugly truth is that Karl Radek was a close associate of the fanatical fellow Pole, Felix Dzerzhinsky, director of the Cheka, the unbelievably brutal state security service. Radek was, in fact, one of the architects of the Red Terror, set in train the very year he met Ransome. We must surely ask the question, if he was Ransome's friend, what sort of friendship could that be? You surely can't befriend one of the more sinister characters of a sinister century. To be specific, how could you possibly befriend an enthusiastic supporter of Lenin's infamous hanging order, issued on August the 11th, 1918. Let me remind you of what this handwritten note says. We need to set an example. Hang without fail. Do it so the public see. At least 100 notorious kulaks, the rich, the bloodsuckers. Publish their names. Take away all their grain. Use your toughest men. You can't befriend someone, surely, who defined his purpose in life as the extermination of enemies of the revolution, pitting class against class, extracting the last ruble, the last fur coat, the last pearl necklace from a tormented bourgeoisie. Not to mince my words, Karl Radek was a monster. How could anyone, least of all the author of Swallows and Amazons, look kindly on someone who watched numberless thousands deprived of the means to live? Someone who looked on unmoved as babies were sold for meat on the streets of Petrograd. So must we conclude that Arthur Ransom was incorrigibly, unbelievably naive? Many, including the critic Ferdinand Mount, have come to that conclusion, but I think they are plainly wrong. Ransom was too intelligent, too perceptive, too well-read, too emotionally engaged. Lola Kinnell was a friend, perhaps more than a friend, who knew Ransom extremely well. This well-connected young woman thought him clever, if a little childish, and I quote, with a queer mixture of contempt, dislike, and love for England. You note this politically astute woman did not find him naive. But what is the alternative? I'm touching, of course, on the vexed issue of where Ransom's true allegiances lay, a topic on which it is impossible to be definitive. In his biography, Roland Chambers flirts with the notion that Ransom was willfully blind to wickedness, almost callous. I think he is also wrong. Indeed, certain events in Ransom's life, and I include the debacle at Durham, will argue for an alternative, more complicated and more painful conclusion. My claim will be that Arthur Ransom, mingling with the crowd as Lenin stepped down from the train, was very far from being the puppet of Munzenberg and Radek. Albeit at that stage no more than a useful amateur, he was already acting as an agent of the British security services. Yes, he was eventually outmaneuvered by professional spies, but this is not particularly to their credit. If Arthur Ransom was naive, it was in one crucial respect only. He appreciated too late that those tempted to practice espionage condemn themselves to a life of duplicity. When he had arrived in Petrograd at the outbreak of World War I in 1914 and was finding his feet in a strange land, in faraway London, the British government was busy establishing the War Propaganda Bureau. At a meeting in a remote country house, all of the significant artists and authors of the age were brought together, sworn to secrecy and recruited to promote the British cause in the Great War. Arthur Conan Doyle, Arnold Bennett, John Masefield, Ford Madox Ford, G.K. Chesterton, John Galsworthy, Thomas Hardy, Rudyard Kipling, H.G. Wells, all were to write patriotic prose to order. Some, you may have noticed, unwittingly or not, were already Munzenberg's innocents. There is a price to pay for this. In Ernest Hemingway's opinion, I quote, there was no really good true war book during the entire 4 years of the First World War. The writers either wrote propaganda, shut up, or fought. The artist Paul Nash, certainly no pacifist, wrote, I'm no longer an artist, I'm a messenger who will bring back word from the men who are fighting to those who want the war to go on forever. Ransom's letters at that time suggest he was not conflicted in the same way. What he was aware of was the price the war was exacting on the weakest and poorest members of Russian society. He proposed setting up an organisation in Petrograd to be called the International News Agency, with the aim of presenting a realistic evaluation of the Russian situation to a worldwide audience. His hopes of actually running it were dashed when the job was given to the novelist Hugh Walpole, but for several years he worked under the aegis of this bureau, producing books, articles and essays jointly with Karl Radak. From Ranson's perspective, what they wrote together was no more than the truth. In no way did it betray the British cause, as he saw it. This was not, of course, Radak's motivation. His aim was to present the most favourable view possible of Bolshevism. And if that involved lying with Ransom's truth, so be it. This uneasy collaboration was not solely literary. In 1918, finding himself unable to leave the country and in great danger, Ransom turned to Radek for help. The price for his escape, one might say, for his life, was to smuggle 3 million rubles out of Russia for the use of Bolshevik International Bureau in Sweden. Apparently, he was given no option. He ensured that MI6 knew all about the arrangement, but he was inevitably and permanently compromised. Oddly enough, then, if Ransom the spy deceived anyone, it was Karl Radek. Ransom's spymaster in Petrograd was the Scottish-born diplomat Bruce Lockhart, a romantic character worthy of a talk in its own right. Lockhart was a friend to both Arthur and Evgenia. If you harbour doubts about where Arthur's true allegiances lie, bear in mind that Bruce Lockhart, together with ace of spies Sidney Reilly, was implicated in a plot to assassinate Lenin. Lockhart was a professional spy, an implacable enemy of the Bolsheviks, committed to their overthrow. If he had believed for a moment that Arthur Ransom, the amateur, was any kind of double agent, he would instantly have unmasked him. Bear in mind also that Lockhart had known Trotsky's secretary, Evgenia Shelepina, long before Ransom even met her. Lockhart had described her to his masters in London as, I quote, a very useful lady who has been of the greatest service to me and is anxious to establish herself in Stockholm, where she would be at the centre of information regarding underground agitation in Russia. More than enough of a hint that her relationship with British intelligence. Perhaps we are dealing not with one amateur spy, but with two. In 1919, Ransom secured permission to join a party of American journalists on a visit to London. The party included William Bullitt, who was to become US ambassador to the new Soviet Union. Ransom almost certainly knew that Bullitt was carrying secret letters from Lenin. It was obviously an espionage operation. He left Evgenia behind to stay with her family in Moscow, taking with him the notes for the book 6 Weeks in Russia, a book that made plain his sympathies for the Russian population, then literally starving in great numbers, without endorsing Bolshevism, indeed declaring himself not a communist. It was a distinction lost on Whitehall's mandarins in Petrograd. News soon arrived in London from Colonel Knox. Knox was the British military attaché in Petrograd. He wrote in some agitation about this rogue journalist who'd got himself entangled with a foreign woman, was fraternizing with the enemy, was little better than a Bolshevik himself. In time-honoured fashion, his recommendation was that Ransom should be shot like a dog. He had no idea, of course, that he was talking about someone who'd been an agent of the British government for many dangerous years. But as John le Carré has taught subsequent generations, it's the fate of spies, amateur or not, to be hung out to dry. The quotation that an ambassador is an honest man sent abroad to lie for his country applies equally to spies. Once you start lying in a good cause, you cease to be honest in any cause.
Far from being welcomed by the London intelligence establishment, as he expected, perhaps even offered a job in the Foreign Office, Arthur was ignominiously arrested at King's Cross Station and bundled off to Scotland Yard. The account of his meeting with Sir Basil Thompson, head of Special Branch, is told as a joke in Ransom's autobiography. Thompson had Ransom's intelligence file in front of him. He was aware that his position in Petrograd had been personally endorsed by two foreign secretaries. He also knew, of course, that Ransom had been forced to smuggle funds on behalf of the Bolsheviks. He well knew the interview was something of a charade. The same cannot be said about the series of menacing meetings with Rex Leeper that took place over the following days. This ambitious young Australian diplomat making his way in the Foreign Office was also well aware of Ransom's true allegiances, writing, "Mr. Ransom is not an agent of the Bolsheviks." He added the gratuitous insult, "He has not enough sense to see through them." He fiercely opposed Ransom ever returning to Russia, throwing in an anti-Semitic jibe to clinch the matter. "His interest is simply for the safety of himself and the Jewess of whom he is enamoured. I've no faith in him whatsoever and could not recommend anybody with so dishonest a mind being sent to that hotbed of all lies." For his part, Ransom had made plain his objection to being interviewed by someone he called a callow young man, someone he referred to as a temporary clerk. He did not realise how dangerous an enemy he had made over the course of these deeply unpleasant interviews. Their paths would cross again. I have brought you to 1919, the birth of the Roaring Twenties, the overture to what Auden called a low, dishonest decade, years that ended in yet another war, years in which Arthur Ransom and Rex Leeper trod very different paths. Evgenia did eventually manage to join Ransom in Sweden, having purchased her own escape from Moscow by agreeing to smuggle pearls for the Bolsheviks. In 1924, they were married. In 1929, back in his beloved Lake District, Ransom persuaded a decidedly unenthusiastic Rupert Hart Davies, a junior partner at CAPE, to publish a book called Swallows and Amazons. And the rest, you might say, is history. Hart Davies became a friend of Ransom, but that did not stop the firm defining him as a difficult author. To read Ransom's diaries is to discover the private face of someone ever more protective of reputation, ever more touchy, even willing now and then to rewrite history a little. The public face was a different matter. A Ransom for Christmas became every child's wish, including mine. The printing press barely able to keep up with the reprints. Ransom was phenomenally successful. Only J.K. Rowling in the present era comes at all close. Even the Queen personally bought a copy of Swallows and Amazons and paid cash for it. But no public honours came Ransom's way. His old boss in Petrograd, Hugh Walpole, was made CBE in 1918 for secret work. In 1937, he was knighted. Ransom's arguably equally influential secret work was not even acknowledged. This is at a time when English authors were routinely honoured. Graham Greene, J.B. Priestley and Aldous Huxley even let it be known that they would not accept mere knighthoods, but would hang on for something better, like an Order of Merit, a tactic that worked for the first two. In 1932, John Galsworthy even received the Nobel Prize in Literature. If you find this lack of public recognition for England's most influential children's writer, Strange, imagine how Ransom felt. He was an extraordinarily perceptive man, perhaps all touchy people are. He was also steeped in the devious ways of espionage. He surely realised he'd become the object of a blacklist. And the reasons for his exclusion from the upper echelon of English cultural life are not too hard to find. In one of the most poorly guarded secrets of World War II, the intelligence agencies purged the civil service of communists and Bolsheviks. Their aim was to ensure that undesirable persons played little part in public life. Indeed, it was not until 1937, the year in which Pigeon Post secured the first Carnegie Medal, that Ransom's MI5 file in the bowels of 124 Cromwell Road was finally declassified. Someone scribbled across the cover of the file, a most mischievous person. Even the note confirming the closure of his file can be seen as a kind of betrayal. He did some good work for us. There has always been a suspicion he was leaning towards Bolshevism. The man charged with bringing about this systematic purge of Bolshevist tendencies in England was Ransom's old nemesis, Rex Leeper. As the country drew closer to war, Leeper headed Britain's secretive political warfare executive. It was he placed in charge of national propaganda. He became one of the most influential figures in English cultural life. Leeper's views on the nature of effective propaganda were only distinguished from those of the Soviet Union by the fact that these were our lies rather than theirs. Radek himself would have happily endorsed the proposition that a willingness to lie is essential to control the public mood. In a secret memorandum to civil servants about the workings of the Emergency Powers Act, written by Leeper, you find this. The people must feel that they are being told the truth. Distrust breeds fear more than knowledge of reverses. The people should be told this is a civilian's war or a people's war, and therefore they are to be taken into the government's confidence. What is the truth? We must adopt a pragmatic definition. It is what is believed to be the truth. The government would be wise, therefore, to tell the truth, and if a sufficient emergency arises, to tell one big thumping lie that will then be believed. It was in this somewhat tainted context that Leeper had founded and then taken charge of the British Council, defining its role in terms not unlike those prepared for the Petrograd News Agency. He pointed to similarities between black propaganda and the task a novelist faced constructing believable fictions. He set out, like Willy Munzenberg, to recruit his secret army of celebrated authors capable of prosecuting Britain's propaganda war. The list was long, but there was no place on it for Arthur Ransom. Defined by others as something of an outsider, Ransom came to define himself as a man doomed to take second place. This response to an ill-concealed closing of ranks against him had consequences for his fiction, in particular his use of what amount to private jokes, or japes as he called them, as autobiographical allusions. I have time for only one example. As they say, read my book if you want others. Is this the reason for the remarkable number of allusions to pearls in Ransom's fiction? Interestingly, they are all allusions, with one exception, to failure or to promise unfulfilled. We know Evgenia bought her life with smuggled pearls. What, one might well ask, did she make of the treasure in Peter Duck, which turned out to be just a few pearls, and not gold after all. And the pearls in Titty's pearl-diving game in Swallows and Amazon, you recall they too lost their allure once they dried out on the bank. The allusion was obviously significant to Ransom because he comes back to it in Swallowdale. I mentioned one exception. Crucially, it occurs in a novel that symbolically places Evgenia center stage, the novel Missy Lee. In Missy Lee, the allusion to pearls is more direct and more audacious. The children are led by Roger, flaunting his pearl to tempt the dragon. But ultimately, it is Missy Lee herself who rescues all of them. The hair-raising description of the descent of the gorge in Missy Lee is one of the most exciting passages in the whole canon, but also one of the most ambiguous. The characters are brought to safety, complete with Captain Flint's smuggled sextant, but by the actions of a strong, capable, determined, yet supremely conflicted woman, a woman who found her loyalties painfully divided. Ransom had good reason to think himself unjustly categorized as an outsider, but he did not restrict his revenge to these gentle literary allusions. There was also a political response, one with dire personal consequences. I refer to his decision to make common cause with someone else hung out to dry, the most celebrated and reviled literary outcast of his age. In June 1940, P.G. Wodehouse had been living for years as a tax exile in Letuke. He was arrested by German troops. Arrested at the same time was a far more obscure British citizen named Noel McIntosh, who was working as a war cemetery gardener. Both were taken to an internment camp, a former lunatic asylum, near Tost in Upper Silesia, Poland. There's plainly not time to talk about the year Wodehouse spent in the camp, except to mention he managed to complete a novel and write three new ones. When he was released, on account of his age, a year later, the mysterious Mr. McIntosh, although far younger, went with him. Both were put up at the Hotel Adlon in Berlin. It was there that McIntosh persuaded Wodehouse to make a series of comic broadcasts over German radio to his readers in the USA. My War with Germany was a light-hearted look at life in the prison camp, faithful to the resolution of the inmates not to whine, not to complain. The joke fell flat, wrong-footing London in the propaganda war. A hysterical campaign of denunciation was hastily set in train. In no time at all, Wodehouse's books were removed from libraries. There were questions in Parliament, calls for having him tried for treason, even executed, along with John Amory and Lord Haw-Haw. At the war's end, Wodehouse was moved to an internment camp outside Paris, a former maternity hospital. Even then, he was far from safe. This was the time of the épuration that followed the fall of the Vichy regime. The traumatized Wodehouse was interviewed for 4 days by Major Edward Cusson of MI6. The Cusson report completely exonerates him. He'd been probably unwise to make the broadcasts, but after all, failed efforts at whimsy hardly justify prosecution, let alone execution. Shamefully, Cusson's report was never published. It was immediately classified, with the name of Wodehouse's mysterious companion, Noel McIntosh, blacked out. We know now he had been an MI6 double agent. Somebody, we will never know who, decided that protecting that name justified leaving the threat of prosecution for treasonable conduct, hanging over Woodhouse for the rest of his life. He never returned to England. It is easy to understand Arthur Ransome's interest in someone like Woodhouse. The two men had carved out remarkably similar paths to success. Both had foregone university, both had been inured to the patronising critiques of their more sophisticated peers, both had unwittingly been drawn into intelligence intrigue, both had been fated to discover that fame and popularity do not secure a place at the top table. And of course, both had been casually betrayed. Both hung out to dry. In August 1941, with this hysteria at its height, Ransome chose to make his position clear. He wrote to friends that Evgenia was reading The Luck of the Bodkins, and the house was rocking with her chuckles. You did not, in 1941, go out of your way to praise P.G. Woodhouse. He was writing Missy Lee at the time, and we've already seen how he sneaked in a joke about smuggling. His reference to The Luck of the Bodkins is part of the same joke. It's a book about efforts to smuggle a pearl necklace through the customs. Its star, Lottie Blossom, is an American film star who keeps an alligator in a wicker basket to deter the customs men. There were other writers willing to risk their reputation defending the reviled Woodhouse, most notably George Orwell, but it was not a risk Ransome could afford to run. In making these very public literary allusions, he had burned the last of his boats. There were bound to be consequences, and these will be found in Durham. On the 10th of February, 1948, Ransome, well into his 60s and still without garlands round his neck, received a handwritten letter out of the blue from Sir James Duff, the Vice-Chancellor of Durham University, giving him advance notice that the registrar would be inviting him to accept an honorary degree. In fact, the formal letter arrived the very next day. Ransome replied at once, accepting enthusiastically. He should perhaps have read the letters more carefully. Both refer to the award of an MA degree, not the customary honorary doctorate. But Arthur Ransome was not a university man, and the distinction seems to have been lost on him. I think Sir James realised this because he sent another letter, this one filled with rather clumsy hints. "Don't bring evening clothes," he wrote, "nor is any kind of formal dress needed for the ceremony." Ransome surely remembered the newspaper pictures of Woodhouse in his Oxford finery. They were widely circulated when the campaign of denunciation was at its height. Duff was obviously warning him, but he missed it. For reasons we need not go into, the role of Vice-Chancellor at Durham in 1948 alternated between two people. While Vice-Chancellor Duff enthusiastically nominated his childhood hero for a degree, it fell to Vice-Chancellor Lord Percy to settle the details. And who is this Lord Percy? Former diplomat, conservative politician, educational reformer. He was rector of King's College, which eventually became Newcastle University. Crucially, he was also at that time chairman of the British Council. You remember the British Council, that creation of Ransome's nemesis, Rex Leeper. Lord Percy and Rex Leeper were close friends. Both men in those far-off revolutionary times had supported the doomed intervention force against the Soviet Russia. Both passionately loathed Bolshevism. Both despised Ransome for what they saw as years of journalistic double-dealing. Decidedly, Lord Percy would not view Arthur Ransome as a suitable candidate
for an honorary doctorate. Much of the correspondence surrounding this affair has disappeared, but the agenda of the Honorary Degree Committee in Durham survives, and I'm grateful to the archivist for making it available. They suggest a lively meeting. Here is one page of the agenda. This was long before the days of the photocopier. Decisions of the committee would have been inked in at the meeting by the registrar or perhaps Lord Percy himself. At the bottom, on the left, you can see Lord Percy's proposed degree for Vita Sackville West got a perfunctory no. There was no such reservation for Miss Edith Sitwell, who was given the green light for an honorary doctorate. Ransom's entry gets off to a bad start. What was written about the children's books is lazily only half true. There is no reference to his work on Wilde and Poe, no reference to his considerable contribution to literary theory, no reference to Russia, no hint at his contribution to Britain's war aims. There was evidently unease at the meeting at the idea of bracketing someone with Arthur Ransom's literary reputation alongside Alderman Adams, however worthy the Cumberland Development Council might be. It seems at one point the discussion led someone desperately to ink in M. Litt as a sort of half-hearted compromise. Too late. The die was cast. Poor Arthur, in his crumpled lounge suit, would have to shuffle past with Alderman Adams and the other also-rans and then sit through the laureation addresses for his betters. I've called all this a debacle, overly dramatic perhaps. After all, who now remembers Lord Percy? Nonetheless, it's worth exploring the motivation for this peculiarly spiteful act. The question remains, why? Return for a moment to that frankly hysterical response to P.G. Woodhouse. You will discover something surprising. There are, in fact, purely literary reasons that his work so greatly infuriated the great and the good of the time. I don't believe for a moment that Churchill thought those broadcasts posed a threat to national security. No, it was a succession of novels out of tune with the political zeitgeist. In this sense, Woodhouse was far more subversive than any number of earnest works by more politically committed authors. George Orwell, at least, seemed aware of this. Woodhouse created a version of reality which had no time for political posturing. Indeed, repeatedly in his work, we brought face to face with the holiness of the heart's affections, an uncomfortable truth in times of war. In the polarized world of the 1940s, more than enough in the eyes of some to declare him a subversive heretic. Can we find a parallel in Ransom? I think the answer is yes. In his best work, and particularly in the Enchanted Lakes novels, you find something equally subversive. Ransom gently reminds his readers of an England rooted in a far distant past, a mythical place, which, while it never existed, we are more than content to inhabit. What is it, asks Margaret Drabble, apart from buttered eggs, marmalade, small boats and fair play, that gives Ransom's fiction its enduring power? Her answer comes close to the truth. The world entered each time one opens one of those well-read books is not the real world. It is a land of myth, not of reality. Far from creating an Edwardian miniature in which children mimic the imperial concerns of their elders, Ransom described children without spite, children devoid of malice, children never cruel, mischievous perhaps, but never mean, never wicked. Little wonder that critics tempered their praise
with profound unease. He had created a world without sin. Some years ago, trying to sum up Ransom's idyllic world, I fell back on a half-remembered quotation. He has made a world for us to live in and delight in. His characters are still in Eden. It was only later, when I chased the quotation down, I discovered the words were Evelyn Waugh's, and he was writing about P.G. Wodehouse.